as to who Jesus is. And one way that John does this is by recording a number of miracles that Jesus did. John doesn't actually call them miracles. What does he call them? He calls them signs, doesn't he? So he calls them signs because miracles are like, these miracles are like signposts that point us to what Jesus is like. That's why they're called signs. In fact, at the end of the book, you will remember that, yes, there were many other signs that Jesus did, but the ones that John records, he says, I have recorded so that you may believe that Jesus... Let's try this. So that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, thank you, the Son of God. These ones are recorded so you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life, thank you, in his name. Now the miracle or sign that we're looking at this evening is especially important in that regard. It matters that once again Jesus is in Jerusalem. That's a bit unusual because most of Jesus' ministry was spent up north in Galilee. And yet most of what John records is actually down in Jerusalem. After this there was a feast of the Jews and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. And so once again it is a feast. And one of the things you'll notice in John is that Jesus often chose to work his miracles on the occasion of a particular Jewish feast. And he does that for a particular reason, because often enough what the feast was all about is what the sign was all about. The two go together. Now in this case we're not told what the feast was, and we're not even going to try and guess. But we are told that it was a special occasion. So what was the special occasion? If you're listening, what was the special occasion? What particular special day was it? It was the Sabbath day. Thank you. It was the Sabbath day. So it was the holy day in which the Jews ceased work and they just focused on worshipping God. And that's significant. Now this is the third great sign that John draws our attention to. There are probably seven signs, and this is the third great sign that he draws his attention to, and his third great sign that he records was on the Sabbath day. So here was a man in very great distress. We're told where it took place. Now there is in Jerusalem by the Sheep Gate a pool which is called in Hebrew Bethesda or some read Bethzatha, having five porches, and in these lay a great multitude of sick people, blind, lame, paralysed, waiting for the moving of the water. And we actually know where this exactly was because they've unearthed the pool of Bethesda or Bethzatha. We've got a picture of that, what it looks like today. You probably wouldn't go there now. And that's actually the pool of Bethesda today. You can get a bit of an idea that it was a pretty deep pool. It was filled with water. The water was actually used to supply the rituals in the temple throughout the whole year. The temple was nearby. Just flip over to the next one. That's another one just looking down, so you get a picture of what it looks like today. And you can see it's a very deep pool. So it held a lot of water. And John then records what may have been, we're going to have to flip back to the Bible verse here, sorry about that. John records what may have been a fact, or it may just have been a popular belief at the time. We're not too sure. Verse 4, for an angel went down at a certain time into the pool and stirred up the water. Then whoever stepped in first after the stirring of the water was made well of whatever disease he had. Some think that's what actually happened. There's absolutely no reason why that isn't what actually happened. Or some think John is simply recording there what the people believed, what they attributed to the fact that some who entered the water did actually get healed. We won't worry about that. It doesn't matter either way, because whatever the case, there was one poor soul here who wasn't getting healed either way. Because it says in verse 5, now a certain man was there who had an infirmity 38 years. Some of you aren't 38 years old. I won't ask you to put up your hand if you're more than 38, but those of you that are more than 38, just try to think back 38 years. I'd only just got married then, for a couple of years anyway. It's a long time ago. It's a long time ago. It's a long time to be sick. And there were lots and lots of people around the pool that day. A lot of sick people. Jesus, we're not told that Jesus approached any of the others. But he did deliberately single out this man, this one man alone. It says in verse 6, when Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he had been in that condition a long time. So of all the people there this day, you have to think, why this one? I wonder why Jesus singled out this particular one, because there were lots of people sick. We're not told that he healed anyone else that day. Maybe he did, but he certainly didn't heal them all. So why this particular one? I think part of the reason would be that this was a particularly hopeless case. I mean, this man had been in this condition for 38 years, and I'm sure doctors don't like facing having to cure someone who's had a particular sickness for 38 years. So, I mean, this is not a person who said, oh, I've been getting a few headaches in the last few days, or someone who just said, oh, I slipped a disc a week ago. This is a man who's been like this for 38 years. I mean, that's 38. Like, count them. That's what John's saying. Count them. 38 years. So there was no chance that this man would ever recover through natural causes. The fact that he was there that day emphasised that only a miracle could help him now, a very great miracle. And Jesus bypassed everyone else around the pool, just homed in on this one particular man, this one hopeless case, probably the most hopeless case that was there that day. So let's have a look at the next picture. This is someone's idea of what it might have looked like at the time. And approaching this poor soul, Jesus puts the question to him and says, do you want to be made well? And you think, you know, what sort of daft question is that? This man's been sick for 38 years. Unfortunately, sometimes people that have been sick that long don't always want to be made well, because they don't know any other life. Like someone who's been in prison for 38 years and they don't really want to get out of prison because they're just not used to anything else. And probably that question was not really so daft anyway, because probably what Jesus is doing is just rubbing it in. He's rubbing in just how hopeless this man's condition is. It's no great miracle if there's no great problem. I mean, if it's just a headache you've had for 3 days, or if it's just, you know, you slipped a disc a week ago, it's not a huge miracle. It might be a small one, but it's not a huge one. So if this is going to be seen as a great miracle, then it's important that it be known that it was a very great problem. And so Jesus rubs it in. He wants the man to admit how great the problem is. And so he says, do you want to be made well? Let's go back to the text. And this poor soul rises to the occasion. He is too sick to move, but unless he moves, he won't get healed. So he's in this conundrum. He just can't work out how he's ever going to get healed. He says in verse 7, sir, I have no man to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up, but while I'm coming, another steps down before me. So what he's saying to Jesus is, look, I am without hope. I need a miracle. The pool is my last chance, but I can't walk. I can't get around. I'm without hope. He doesn't actually answer the question, do you want to be healed? He just talks about how hopeless his condition is. Now, at this point, Jesus could have been there simply as a friend. Friend's always good. And he could have offered to stay there with the man until the water was troubled, and then he could take him down to the water, because obviously for 38 years he hadn't had a friend who would take him to the water. Or for that matter, Jesus could have commanded the angel to come down and trouble the water right then and there, and then he could have helped this poor sick man down to the water before anyone else. But that wouldn't be a sign, would it? Where would be the miracle that Jesus did in that? And so instead he does this in verse 8. Jesus said to him, "Rise, take up your bed and walk." "I can't walk. I can't get around." "Rise." "I can't walk. I can't get around. Take up your bed." "I can't walk. I can't get around. Walk." Seems almost cruel, doesn't it, when you think about it? Imagine saying that to a crippled man. "Rise, take up your bed and walk." But it's not cruel if you have faith. That's the point. There are a lot of things that the Lord commands you to do in the Bible that the world calls cruel, but they are kind if you have faith. There are many things that God commands you to do in His Word that you complain, I can't do it. How could God possibly expect me to do it? That's cruel for God to command me to do that. And that's just a lack of faith. If you believed God and did as He commanded, you would find that what you readily dismiss as cruel is actually His kindness toward you. Verse 9. "And immediately the man was made well." Immediately. There was no delay. This was not, well, yes, Jesus said, "You'll get well, and over the next 2 weeks I really got a lot better, so it's a miracle." It wasn't that kind of healing. It was immediately. The man had been sick for 38 years, and now, immediately, he is cured. "Immediately, the man was made well. He took up his bed and he walked." So that is a great miracle. And if you've been there, you would recognise that. We read about it today, we've read about it before, and we forget how great a miracle it was, but it was a very great miracle. Now, it was more than just a very great miracle, it was a very great sign. John makes the point in this account of the case of the person who was sick. John makes the point noting just how hopeless his condition was. But John also makes the point of the occasion when Jesus healed him. "Immediately the man was made well and took up his bed and walked. And that day was the Sabbath." And John has a habit of doing this. He keeps on reminding us of the occasion when it happened. The first sign, the occasion, was actually the wedding feast. Other miracles, it was the feast of the Passover, or it was the feast, whatever it was in chapter 7, I forget. And he reminds us of the occasion. This time, the occasion was the Sabbath. So Jesus deliberately chose the most hopeless case to heal, but he also deliberately chose the Sabbath day on which to heal this one solitary soul. So what was Jesus trying to teach you and me by that? Because remember, signs aren't just miracles. Signs are there to teach us something about Jesus. So what was Jesus teaching us here? And as with many of Jesus' signs, the meaning is tied to the occasion. The occasion was the Sabbath day. Now, the Sabbath day was a holy day. It was a day on which the Lord's people were commanded to do no work. Their focus was to be upon worshipping the Lord, giving their attention to worshipping the Lord. And even today, living as we do in New Testament times, the Sabbath today, the Sabbath command still applies, just as do the rest of the Ten Commandments. So far, so good. But by the time of Jesus, the Jews, the Pharisees in particular, had become mighty picky when it came to what you could or could not do on the Sabbath day. Here are some of the Pharisees' regulations that they had imposed upon the Sabbath, which they had taken to stupid extremes. They said, a woman should not look in a mirror on the Sabbath day. Because, now actually, so, don't blame me, this is the Pharisees, okay? They didn't say a man, they actually said a woman. A woman should not look in the mirror on the Sabbath day because she might see a grey hair. And then she might pluck it, and that would be work. They said, if you have a sore throat on the Sabbath day, it's okay to swallow vinegar to ease the pain, but you mustn't gargle, because that is work. They said, if a hen broke the Sabbath by laying an egg on the Sabbath day, goodness, it's okay, you can eat the egg as long as you kill the hen. And so when these people saw, when the Pharisees saw this man carrying his bed, which was just a mat, by the way, it wasn't, you know, a four-poster, when they saw him carrying his bed on the Sabbath day, they almost had apoplexy. And in verse 10, the Jews therefore said to him who was cured, it is the Sabbath, it is not lawful for you to carry your bed. I want you to really think about that verse. You look at the beginning of that verse. The Jews therefore said to him who was cured. And you would think their next words would be, wow, that's wonderful. You're cured. What a miracle. Praise God. But their next words are, it is the Sabbath, it's not lawful for you to carry your bed. That is their response to this sign. That's their response to this miracle. Verse 11, he answered them, he who made me well said to me, take up your bed and walk. Then they asked him, who is the man who said to you, take up your bed and walk? Don't you love it or hate it? He who made me well, you know, it's me, this one, who had this incurable disease for 38 years and I just lay there and couldn't do a thing. And this one came along and he made me well. And then he said, take up your bed and walk. Okay, so who is this wonderful person who made you well? No. Who is this terrible person who said to you, take up your bed and walk? So there's been this great sign, this great miracle. And nothing like this has ever happened before, at least not in the lifetime of the Pharisees. But all they can think about is their precious Sabbath regulations. They miss the significance of this sign. That's why a sign is called that, because it is significant. It is significant in pointing to something about the person. And they missed admiring this miracle. That's why a miracle is called a miracle, because it causes you to admire what has happened and admire the person who did it. But all they can see, they can't see a great miracle or a great sign, all they can see is a great sin. And so great do they believe Jesus' sin is here that they even plan to kill Jesus. In verse 16, we see, for this reason the Jews persecuted Jesus and sought to kill him because he had done these things on the Sabbath. Now, I want you to really notice the way Jesus responds to this charge, because this is the crux of it. Because if you miss this, then you miss what this passage is all about. This is the whole point of the sign. There are a number of ways that Jesus could have responded, because this is not the first time that Jesus has been rebuked for doing something on the Sabbath. If you remember back when we were going through Mark's Gospel, you remember that one time, I think in Mark chapter 3, the Jews took Jesus to task because he was healing on the Sabbath. And Jesus said then, it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath, it is lawful to save a life. He could have used that excuse here, couldn't he? On another occasion, he could have defended himself by appealing, or he did defend himself by appealing to how we even try and help our animals on the Sabbath. And he said, you know, which of you having a donkey or an ox and it falls into a pit doesn't get down there and pull him out and help your animal? And Jesus could have said that on this occasion. And Jesus could have said lots of things to point out that, yes, it is important to keep the Sabbath, but the Sabbath is not broken by doing what is necessary or what is merciful. And he could have said any of those things here, but he doesn't. He doesn't say that here. Because that's not what this passage is all about. If you read this passage and you simply think that this passage is about how we should or should not keep the Sabbath, then you miss the whole point, because that's not what the passage is about. I want you to look at Jesus' response in verse 17. Jesus answered them, "My Father has been working until now, and I have been working." My Father has been working until now, and I have been working. You see? That has nothing to do with how you and I should or shouldn't keep the Sabbath. This is all about how God keeps the Sabbath. Jesus is saying, yes, I have been working. It is the Sabbath. There is one who never has to justify working on the Sabbath. That is God. Let me explain. Five years ago, on the 26th of July, I was admitted to hospital for some serious surgery. On the 29th of July, exactly 3 days later, I was discharged. That was pretty quick, I thought, for the surgery I'd had. And Eileen, for one, was a little bit concerned. In fact, she was a lot concerned. In fact, she almost had apoplexy because she thought it was too early to be coming home. The day I came home was a Sunday. It was our Sabbath day. And I would have been greatly concerned if I had thought that God knocked off on the Sabbath day and took a rest. But thankfully, I knew that God does not take a rest on the Sabbath day. Because under God's hand, sick people still continue to recover on the Sabbath day. And under God's hand, thousands, millions of people continue to get better on the Sabbath day. And under God's hand, millions, billions of his creatures throughout the world get fed on the Sabbath day. All because God continues to work on the Sabbath day. And yes, you and I are commanded to rest, we're commanded to cease, we're commanded to focus on worshipping God on the Sabbath day. That is for our benefit, it is not for God's. God does not rest, and thankfully he continues to work. So I was not particularly concerned, that was probably partly the anaesthetic still working, but I was not particularly concerned that God would not continue to look after me the day I was discharged, even though it was the Sabbath day, because God doesn't take a rest on the Sabbath day. God has been giving you your food today. He's been helping your lungs to go in and out and breathe air on the Sabbath day. God has been giving you shelter on the Sabbath day. God has been providing you moment by moment all throughout this day. And if he did not, none of us would survive. So you see what Jesus is saying there? He's saying, you know what this sign is all about? My Father has been working unto now, and I have been working. God works on the Sabbath day. He has to work on the Sabbath day. I work on the Sabbath day for exactly the same reason. Do you get it? I am God. I'm equal with God. And that's what this sign was all about. And you know what? The Jews got it. Verse 18. Therefore the Jews sought all the more to kill him, because he not only broke the Sabbath, but also said that God was his Father, making himself equal with God. And what does being equal with God mean? Well, Jesus goes on to explain that in the following verses that we read. He tells us in his own words what his relationship with God the Father is like. For example, in verse 19, he says, "The Son can do nothing of himself but what he sees the Father do, and whatever he does, the Son also does in like manner." Whatever God does, Jesus does. What Jesus does exactly reflects what God the Father does. Then in verse 20, he says, "For the Father loves the Son and shows him all things that he does. There is nothing that the Father does that the Son doesn't know about. There is nothing the Father hides from the Son. All that the Father knows, the Son knows." Or as it says in verse 22, "The Father judges no one, but has committed all judgment to the Son." We know that the whole of this world is going to a conclusion. On the last great day, God is going to judge the world, but he's going to give that judgment to the Son. It is actually Jesus Christ who's going to judge you and me at the last day. And then the one that really got up the nostrils of the Pharisees, verse 23, "That all should honour the Son just as they honour the Father. He who does not honour the Son does not honour the Father who sent him." So if someone says, "It's okay, I worship God, but I'm not so interested in this Jesus you talk about," doesn't worship God, doesn't honour God. Because Jesus said, unless you honour the Son as you honour the Father, you don't honour the Father at all. You cannot worship God without Jesus Christ. The only way you can worship God is with Jesus Christ. And there can be absolutely no doubt as to what Jesus meant there. Okay, back before in verse 18, where he said, where it says, "The Jews sought all the more to kill him because he not only broke the Sabbath, but also said that God was his Father, making himself equal with God." You might think, oh, come on, you know, you've really misunderstood what Jesus said there. You're just overreacting. Jesus isn't really saying he's equal with God. You've just misinterpreted it. Well, there's no room for misinterpretation of verse 23, "That all should honour the Son just as they honour the Father. He who does not honour the Son, he who does not honour Jesus Christ, does not honour the Father who sent him." There's no misunderstanding there. Jesus is claiming to be equal with God. So, wrapping it up, what does this mean when it comes to John's overall purpose for writing this book? Remember, he wrote these things so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, that he is the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. He wrote these things that you may have life. If you want life, you have to go to God through Jesus. In verse 21, "As the Father raises the dead and gives life to them, even so the Son gives life to whom he will." Jesus is equal with God. Jesus is the one who gives life. And that means that to get life, you have to go to Christ. You don't go to Muhammad, and you don't go to the great rainbow serpent, and you don't go to even what you think is God or a God apart from Jesus Christ, but you have to go to Christ. And then, having found Christ, it is Christ who continues to be the source of your life. He continues to be life to you. Christ never sleeps. He's always watching over you, the same as God the Father. He who keeps Israel shall neither slumber nor sleep, is what the Bible says. The Lord is your keeper. The Lord is your shade on your right hand. He will not allow your foot to be moved. He who keeps you will not slumber. Christ never sleeps. The Father never sleeps. My Father has been working until now, and I have been working. That's why the Bible says, "Therefore, he is able to save to the uttermost those who come to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them." And he's able to save you to the uttermost.